Yeah, thanks very much, Lars. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you all for turning up. Can I just see quickly how many of you are from the atmospheric or boundary layer program? Okay, this is the crowd over there and there. And the dark matter program? Okay. And quantum thermal? Okay, that's the little there. Right. And anybody else? Right? Okay, excellent. Right, so we're a good mix. As you can see, I've already started preparing, and so as you can see, what this is about is basically about this middle place there, right? So let me start on this side. So as you know, on the one hand side we have a microscopic world, and which is very well described by something that you all know, called quantum theory. And quantum theory describes photons, electrons, atoms, you know, the really small stuff. And what many of us are most interested in are things like quantum superposition states that are non-classical states, so what we write often like this, for example, electrons spin up or down in a superposition. And quantum theory also allows us to have quantum correlations, such as entanglement. Of course, this is something about quantum systems being correlated, so two or more quantum systems being correlated in a manner that you can't describe classically. So I'm not, of course, explaining the detail here, but the point is that you have to describe them with joint probabilities that violate Bell's inequality, which actually assumes local realism. So in other words, quantum systems don't fulfill local realism anymore. So what's the use? The use of this is what we today call quantum technology. So one of them is, for example, quantum cryptography. So that's about sending secret messages securely. So what is used in cryptography? Well, one of those features, superpositions, basically is the thing that makes quantum cryptography work. Another quantum technology is quantum computing. You've probably all heard of D-Wave and all these things nowadays. So quantum computing is supposed to be faster than classical computing. We're still in the development phase here. So what is the source of the power there? Well, one could simply say it's quantum correlations. Of course, I'm simplifying matters a lot. And there are other quantum technologies that are being developed. And in the UK, for example, but everywhere in the world, I think in the US, there's also some quantum program starting up. I don't know very much about it. So quantum metrology and sensing is about sensing more accurately, for example, mass or forces and things like that using quantum particles. Okay, so that was the microscopic world. And then we have the macroscopic world over here. So this is the really old-fashioned stuff. This is actually described by thermodynamics, right? So thermodynamics is the theory that describes gases, solids, liquids, all these big stuff. And the main point of it is that it reduces the complexity of 10 to the 23 or so atoms or so to just a few macroscopic parameters, such as temperature, pressure, energy, and entropy is, of course, the key concept in thermodynamics. And the power of it is that it establishes universal laws. So you will all be familiar with, for example, the first law and the second law, that describe, they basically say, what thermodynamic processes can you do? So you start with your system with some initial energy and entropy. You can do some general thermodynamic process, changing your system so a gas can expand or you can cool it or so. And during that, you change the energy and the entropy. And at the same time, you bring in heat, Q, and work, W. And so this first and second law state how you can do that. Okay. And of course, that means that certain processes cannot happen, so there is this inequality sign, and actually this introduces the irreversibility into physics, so that's a core contribution from thermodynamics. Right, what is it used for? Well, it's useful because it derives efficiencies of engines, and that was very important, for example, for the Industrial Revolution, where, of course, the steam engines are described by thermodynamics, so the optimization of those engines uses thermodynamics. And of course, many technological developments rely on thermodynamics. A lot of stuff talks about temperature and so on and so on. So all of this relies on these macroscopic parameters. And of course, a lot of other sciences also rely on thermodynamics, such as chemistry, other than physics. What we've seen in the last couple of years, or maybe 20 or so, is that actually quantum, I said photons, electrons, all this really small stuff behaves quantum mechanically. But in the last years, we've seen larger and larger things behave quantum mechanically. So there are experiments that show that even biomolecules or molecules of 10,000 or more particles actually show quantum effects. So basically, we are entering this regime in the middle and have quantum effects at larger scales. And at the same time, these technologies that are underpinned by thermodynamics, they, as you all know, become smaller and smaller, right? So everything, like manufacturing, chips, everything becomes smaller, and a lot of the technologies are relying on thermodynamics. And so as you can see, we have a problem, because actually for future development and optimization of technologies and even fundamental understanding, we don't have a theory that actually describes the middle. So this is what our field is about, trying to find a fundamental theory that combines some of the properties of quantum mechanics, superpositions, entanglement, and all that stuff, and the thermodynamic ideas together. So this field is still emergent. So I would say, I mean, of course, there's a lot of old work. Bonnie is one of the people who have been working all your life on it. But what I know is that it's only started around maybe 5 to 10 years ago that it got really big. And now there's a very active community exploring this direction. And I have no chance at all to really explain to you what we're doing. But I'll try a little bit and then just give up and have a coffee, okay? So what is this quantum thermodynamics framework supposed to do? Well, it's supposed to include, so quantum thermodynamics. Is meant to include first of all, we want to be able to think about finite size systems. So not just 10 to the 23, so the thermodynamic limit is now not the case anymore, something smaller is important. So one of the implications of this is that fluctuations become very important. So in macroscopic systems, you can forget about fluctuations, yes?
I should have thought you'd have statistical mechanics.
Yeah, good point, yes. Yeah, it's also there.
Somewhere in the middle.
It is. Okay, let's put statistical mechanics there. I mean, statistical mechanics was developed to understand microscopically thermodynamics, right? So normally you take the thermodynamic limit, right? So n to 10 to the 23, and so in a way it's also about the same macroscopic world, but describing it from microscopic properties. But we can argue about them. So finite size systems, the fluctuations matter. So then, of course, quantum properties. And also out of equilibrium dynamics. So you are not just interested in statics, but out of equilibrium dynamics is also something you're interested in.
Statistical mechanics does not apply to everything, all this?
Yes. Well, no. Yeah, okay. Statistical physics has many of those elements, and you could also call it quantum statistical physics. Okay, but that term is already...
But it is a consequence of the statistical mechanics. It's not a separate issue. There's no quantum thermodynamics per se. Whatever you derive from statistical mechanics would be your equilibrium or non-equilibrium.
I'm not sure I get the point.
No, I mean that in this way statistical mechanics does include, you know, all these quantities include thermodynamics, right?
Yes.
So in this way, once you have statistical mechanics, you can approach all of those questions.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering about naming, why you call it quantum thermodynamics.
So the name is a dilemma. So basically we don't know how to call us. Because you're right, that quantum thermodynamics doesn't make that much sense, because a lot of the stuff we actually do is sort of statistical mechanics with a bit of quantum in it. The problem is we can't call it quantum statistical mechanics because that already exists. It's bosons and fermions. And what we do, it goes a bit farther than that. Any suggestions of what we should so I agree. But okay, so these are some of the aspects we want to cover. As discussed, that's already partially in statistical physics, but we want to go a step further. And three things I want to discuss here today is actually, let me do it like this. So one of them is called work extraction. And also engines, quantum engines. Another aspect is the link between thermodynamics and information theory. And another topic. Eat your lunch. So another topic that I picked as interesting is what we would call quantum stochastic thermodynamics. Which has a bit to do with measurement. It's one of the things that comes in here. So remember, the title of our program was this. Maybe it's easier to actually say thermodynamics of quantum systems. So it has engines here and measurement and control, which sort of has to do with all of these things. Right. So these are the three things I want to talk about. Let's start with the first one. Right, so work extraction. So how does it work in classical thermodynamics? Well, let's talk about it. So I can see that some people are experts and some people have not thought about thermodynamics for a very long time. So excuse me if I'm doing very simple things here first. So let's think of a box with some gas in it. So here's a ball that's movable. So it's got little wheels on it here. It can slide along here. Okay, so this is the wall, and we've got a gas here, and that gas, say, is in equilibrium, so it's got a temperature and a pressure and all that, but it lives in a volume that's actually not the maximum volume, because it actually can push against that wall, move the wall, so in that sense, it's not actually in equilibrium, it doesn't fill the full volume, which is this one. So in that sense, it's a non-equilibrium configuration, and we can extract work from this configuration by attaching what we often call a bucket. So here's a bucket that you can raise by letting the gas do work against that wall and raise the bucket. Okay, so this is how you get work from a classical gas. And now, So basically you can use slightly non-equilibrium states to push you back to thermoequilibrium and at the same time do work. So that's how it works. So non-equilibrium in the classical sense, that would be, say you have a system that has energies E0, E1, and so on. The classical sense of non-equilibrium is, or let's say equilibrium, first of all, is when you have just a Boltzmann distribution for each of these energies being occupied. That would be equilibrium. And non-equilibrium is when that's not the case, and that's, so to say, the source of work in some sense.
Is there any system in equilibrium, according to this definition? Any natural system in equilibrium?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, this is...
What would be an example, for example?
Everything. So any gas in equilibrium has this type of distribution and
or a spin system. I guess I mean a realistic system.
Okay. How realistic do you want it? Absolutely. I mean, it's an optimized view, of course. In reality, nothing is perfectly in equilibrium, but you know. So this is a Boltzmann distribution. So this would be equilibrium, non-equilibrium when it's outside of this distribution. And we already discussed a little bit about quantum statistical mechanics. And there, of course, the equilibrium distribution looks slightly different than this when you have boson and fermionic statistics. But what we're interested in is the fact that, so when we think about quantum mechanics, then we think of it as actually the system being described by density operator, okay, so it's a matrix, and this is a matrix in the energy basis, so, okay, this is quantum mechanics, right, so the energy basis are energy eigenstates, E0, E1, and so on. And so this is a matrix in that basis, and the probabilities of taking a certain energy are here, so P0, E1, right? So these are the probabilities of being in that particular energetic configuration, and these can be in equilibrium like this or out of equilibrium. But what's new now is that you can also have coherences. So this is very quantum. You can't have that classically. So what are these? So these are superposition states. So these are superposition states of having, for example, E0 and E1. So the question, I mean, the simple question is now, can you get extra work from such a non-equilibrium situation, right? I told you can get work in the classical case. Can you now get extra work? And the simplest answer to that question is yes, you can. Okay. So you can get extra work from quantum coherences. That's a bit surprising, isn't it? So next question.
What about an example? Is there an easy example for this? Can
I explain this afterwards to you? It takes a little while to explain it. So one can get work out of it, but when I say you get work out of it, so look at this here. You get work out once, right? So you get your gas, expands, you raise the bucket, you get work out, and that's it. Of course, this is not really what you often want, because what you really want is you want to run engines, so that cyclically do something. So next question is, can you get work or extra work in a cycle? That actually would amount to basically saying this second law of thermodynamics is different in the quantum regime than it is in the classical regime. If you could get more out of it, it would sort of imply that something changes here. And as far as I know, the answer is no. We don't have a different second law in quantum mechanics. Okay, so you can't cyclically get more work. In one run you can, but cyclically you can't. But then the next question is, actually, you know what, when you run an engine, you're not interested in how much work it produces. You're interested in how much work per time it produces. Because actually, the Carnot efficiency that comes from that second law is anyway only achieved in a quasi-static limit, so very, very slowly. That's not what you practically care about. You care about power. So next question, can you get more power out of a quantum engine that runs cyclically? And the answer is yes. So Ram and Ronnie, for example, have a paper on this. Maybe I have to start. So this is a paper by Bustin and others in PRX. In 2015, so they show that you can get more power out of a quantum engine. Okay, so that sort of concludes my first topic, I think. I don't want to go into much more detail. These are sort of the main messages.
Of course, yes. It will depend on your interaction.
It depends on absolutely everything. It depends, absolutely.
It will depend on
absolutely.
Interaction,
it depends on the system. Is it the gas? Is it qubits? Is it this and that? It depends on the protocol. How do you run this process? How, you know, in particular, how are the interactions? How do you control it? How do you measure it? There's lots and lots of detail involved, and of course, all the papers are about the detail. Yes.
How much more power is it? Like a lot, or is it?
Ronnie?
Well, it's a different scaling, so yes. It really behaves quantitatively different. When you run the machine faster and faster, then you see that the classical machine, for example, will virtually give you zero power. Okay. It will not work. While a quantum machine will actually saturate to a certain fixed power, and that depends on the details. So it's quantitatively different. Not just numbers.
When you are writing this dense semantics, imagine that it is like a kind of quantum system, right? And it is energy eigenstate. Then I would say that it would be still diagonal, because it become of diagonal because when there's a subsystem of something, but if you consider the whole system, it will be just the same as it was before.
So you're asking whether you can actually have a superposition state of
different
energies?
Yeah. Because you're preparing superposition, but it is corresponds that there is a part of the system, and then the subsystem, not the whole system.
Yes. Yeah, that's experimentally, this is not easy to make. You do need something to exchange. You need like a phase. You need something else that actually locks this superposition. Yeah. Because the superposition actually implies that you have a certain phase fixed between these states, and that means you have a reference, and that is an additional system. You're right. Yes?
I'm a bit curious how the limit back to the classical equivalent happens. Like, when is your system classical enough that you no longer get this extra
work? You can't really have coherences in a classical
right.
system, and there's a separate
right.
discussion of how this limit works. So that's one answer. Some people are also looking at the statistics and looking at, if you have one system and if you have multiple copies of the system, then if you take many, 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 many copies, then it becomes basically classical again as well. And you can show this mathematically. So there are certain ways of showing this link.
Are there any simple examples of when you would want to use such a quantum engine?
More power is always good, no? As far as I understood, the answer now is like if you have a choice between zero and more than zero, then anything is good enough. Of course, it depends on the situation always. But it's an emerging field, so we don't really know many of the answers. But we are inspired by the technologies that come, the quantum technologies such as cryptography and computing, where we've seen these quantum effects give us an actual advantage that we do care about. We're not yet ready to really say, this is exactly the situation where you should use your quantum engine.
It seems like fundamentally, even in quantum statistical mechanics, one uses a kind of coarse graining, and that's what's breaking down.
Yes.
Here.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you have to go back to that point.
Yeah.
And see, for instance, averaging over a Gibbs ensemble is the wrong idea here, it seems.
Basically, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that's
there are many assumptions that you make in classical thermodynamics and in classical statistical physics that you have to question and you have to revisit and see whether this situation is still correct. Yeah. Okay. More questions? Okay. Then let me talk about the next one. So quantum stochastic thermodynamics. Yeah, okay. So I'm not actually going to explain it, I don't think, because let me just write down a couple of things. So this is the second law. So if you, okay, I need the picture. So the picture is here. So suppose you have a system. And so when we talk about heat and work being exchanged with the system, so here is again something that can do work. So I'm thinking of this as a piston that can push my system or be pushed. So this gives work to the system. And then I often have a bath. So here's a bath. So normally it's meant to be very large, and it's normally meant to be in thermal equilibrium, and it exchanges also energy with the system, and that energy is called heat. So the second law here states that the entropy change of a system, so the entropy change of the system in a thermodynamic process where we may exchange heat with the bath and push with the piston, is bigger than this. And suppose we only have one bath, then the temperature is constant and this simply becomes Q over T. Right, so, yes, yeah, so the main thing about quantum stochastic thermodynamics here is that how do you now think of such a process of exchanging heat and work with the system? And we want to think about it in a sort of trajectory picture, okay? So normally in a classical case, you think about, say like this, so you do a little bit of work on your system with your piston, and then you do a little bit of heat on your system by coupling to the valve. And then you do that again and again. So this is how you do thermodynamic processes, by interlacing such exchanges. And then you can sum up the heat and the work, and this is always going to be true. So this is the classical picture. Now, what happens in the quantum regime is something new. So you still have work, and you still have heat, like this. But then there's another thing, and that is actually measurement, okay? This never appeared in classical physics. In classical physics, you don't have to look. It simply happens. But in the quantum system, you don't just have exchange with these two classical objects. You can also do a measurement on the state. I mean, if you haven't done quantum mechanics lately, then you probably don't really know what I'm talking about. But measurement is a big deal in quantum theory, and you know, there's this measurement problem. And in the thermodynamic setting, there's another aspect, which is basically the measurement. So how did I write it down? So yeah, so this one here is work exchange. And this one here is, so this is the piston. This one here is heat exchange. So this is the bath. And this here, it doesn't yet have a proper name. Actually, Alexia Ofef, who's also here, so we call it the quantum heat. And this is, so quantum heat. And this is basically exchange with the measurement device. So basically there's another player in this whole thing. And yeah, that changes the whole analysis of everything. I don't know really how to explain this. So I mean, to briefly say, what happens here, so in a work process, you take, say, some energetic state, like the ground state, to the next level, the first excited state, and it's deterministic, completely deterministic. Heat exchange means that your ground state can go, say, to E1, or some other state, E2, different energetic states, and this is a probabilistic process, right? It's heat exchange, anything can happen. And this quantum heat here is also a probabilistic process. So remember maybe your quantum mechanics lectures. When you do a measurement on a system, you have probabilistic outcomes. And in that sense, this is a heat because it's a random process where you get random outcomes. But it's something that you wouldn't have in a classical system because there's no such measurement problem. Okay, so... Well, Alexei can explain more about it, but Actually, it's Cyril is here as well. And it was, what was it? Energy, no, something.
But if you, let's say that you have discrete levels, okay, and you're doing this adiabatically, then nothing like this can happen because just ground state level is changing, that's it, and there is no this
yes.
other state.
Yes, yes.
But that and is normally there is relaxation, right? Even if you do it faster, then it depends how fast you are doing this.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So a thermodynamic process includes a discussion of the time scale on which you do these operations. So how long do you put something in contact with the bath? How fast?
But then it's not. Then it's not equilibrium state. So
it is not.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not. I mean, when you have a superposition state of two energies, say E0 plus E1, right? So something like this. What happens when you take a system in such a state and couple it to a bath? It will thermalize. But the heat that bath can exchange is classical. So how can that be that you have something classical and it removes these coherences? So there's something else that actually measures and takes
yeah,
away the coherences.
The classical limit corresponds that you do it slow that it's adiabatic. And then there is no this superposition.
Sure, you can, but the point is you can also not do it like this,
yeah,
and then
okay.
things are different. Yes.
I mean, what qualitative effects
does
one distinguish quantum heat from heat? Energy
yeah, so first of all, it's the heat exchange is basically because this is a heat path which is meant to be classical. So it's like a big gas of classical particles. They can't exchange something quantumly. So they cannot be the measurement device.
Well, I in terms of the sort of outcome of a given experiment, is there some difference from? I mean, obviously, presumably, it doesn't scale with temperature for starters, but
yes,
is there some effects of that heat?
Yes, it's that's not easy to explain. Alexei, do you want to comment? The difference between quantum heat and classical heat? I mean, it really is about the fact that this heat is being exchanged with a classical bath temperature and so on.
I understand the sort of underpinnings of it.
Yes.
It's more of a question of
what is the effect of this?
Are there distinct sort of outputs that result from
yes, I mean, we are looking at several things, like this is very much ongoing. I mean, the paper was last year, I think.
There was another paper showing that you can actually really extract energy from this quantum heat. So make an engine working with this quantum heat.
I see.
There's no hot gas, you just look at the guy and you can extract energy from the very fact of looking at it.
The measurement driven.
Somehow it's being drawn from the measuring device or something.
Absolutely.
But
it's stochastic. So.
But I do not understand why you call it measurement. The fact that you have different states is not measurement by itself. You have these states, and quantum theory gives you what states they are.
I suggest we discuss this afterwards.
Okay.
Yes.
Why isn't that process more like in parallel?
In parallel. Excellent question.
Yeah.
So this is like the usual physics assumption, and you can split your time so small that basically for a very, very tiny interval of time, you can think of it as just doing one exchange. And that simplifies the analysis. If you can't do it, then it's difficult to talk about anything. So that makes the analysis possible.
Is there an order of limits issue there? Because the time scale will be shorter than the inverse gap between the states.
Oh, I mean, sorry, I didn't quite
understand. As the time scale is short enough, then the energy uncertainty is large, right? So then there must be some order of limits in saying I can break things up in the short time steps.
I'm not sure I understand.
if the time scales are short between individual processes, then the energy uncertainty is going to be huge.
Yes.
That energy uncertainty is bigger than.
Yes.
Maybe that's what the quantum heat is all about.
Good suggestion. I don't know. Maybe.
No, I wouldn't say it's related to energy uncertainty. It's more the fact that measurement has a back action on systems. So if there is a back action, then you can fluctuations.
So that's distinct. But I mean, by breaking things up, there's only if you go too short, then the energy uncertainty is so huge.
Yes.
It's a that will come out into work fluctuations, which is one of the issues.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, for example, it depends also on the actual experimental realization that you're thinking about. For example, if you, say, have a quantum system, like a qubit system, sitting there and undergoing unitary evolution, which is closed evolution, then that's a work process. There's no heat exchange whatsoever. And then suddenly, maybe a photon comes out of this qubit, and you detect that photon, and that's where you see that actually something has happened, and that would be quantum heat, because this wasn't exchanged with a heat buff as temperature T, that was a measurement where the system has actually been measured, and because of that, it's been measured by the environment, and that environment has got this photon now from the... Do I explain this correctly? So, okay. Right, so, I mean, briefly, there is something called stochastic thermodynamics, so not quantum, and that's all about fluctuation relations. Anybody heard ever about fluctuation relations? Okay, some people. Okay, good. So, I mean, there are things like this. So this is a classical fluctuation relation called Dzerzhinsky equation. And that's about basically linking the non-equilibrium work here with equilibrium free energy differences. And that's a very general statement, and it's very useful for experiments where you can actually measure this and you want to know this. So you can then use this relationship to find out this. And one of the questions is, how does this become quantum? So I need to explain this briefly. So this here is an average over different trajectories in phase space. So you need to take this work over different runs of your experiment. Each time you look in phase space, what has happened to the particle, and then you take an average, and then you get this. But in quantum mechanics, normally we don't talk about trajectories in phase space. So one of the discussions is, how do you generalize this equality to the quantum regime? And for that, you need that type of picture, where you sort of create trajectories that have these components, and then you have some sort of statistics for the work for different trajectories, and you can construct something similar to that. Okay, that's why we do that. Okay, I can of course explain much more detail if you want to hear about it in detail later. Okay, let me move on to the last one, and then we can have coffee. So the last one is about the link between thermodynamics and information theory. Right, so who of you has heard of Landau's principle? Okay, you guys, okay, good. Right, not so many of you. Wow, that's astonishing. Yeah. I mean, sorry, this is in no way, I mean, to us this is like bread and butter, so we can't really understand anymore how you couldn't know. But then we don't know what you do, of course. Right, so... yeah, maybe I explain this like this. So again, let me start 1850s. This is the time when thermodynamics was invented, right? So we already talked about thermodynamics a bit, and it's this microscopic stuff. And then we also talked about statistical physics. So statistical physics came around 1900. So statistical physics is basically the microscopic description of thermodynamics. At least that's how I see it. And then there was, in the 1950s, something new came along, and that's information theory. So one of the things that's odd about, information, you know bits, you know zeros, ones, and all that stuff. Shannon, maybe you've heard the name before. So that's what, of course, describes some type of engine, right? Just like thermodynamics, but it describes engines that manipulate information. So instead of engines that manipulate energy here, these engines manipulate information. And they also, these guys in information theory, they also have something called entropy, S, entropy called Shannon entropy. That's actually the unit of a bit. So this is somewhat similar to thermodynamics, right? So this is also engines, and there's also an entropy, let's call it thermodynamic entropy. Right? So there are some similarities. But it took a while until really it became more clear how the similarities are. And this was in the 60s. So in the 60s, Landauer showed that in some simplistic way, okay, let's see whether anybody's going to kill me now. In some simplistic way, you can say that actually the thermodynamic entropy is equal to the Shannon entropy. Right, so... So how did he argue? He argued one thing, namely, okay, let me explain this because you don't know. So suppose you have a double well potential and you have a particle, say you think of a gas that's sort of in that double well potential, and you have one particle that sits in that double well, and say this is the one state and that's the zero state. And it can be either on this side or that side, right? So the initial state is either this or that. And now the question is, how much energy do you need to spend to erase, okay? Erasure is that if you have either the particle there or there, the erasure makes this particle go here for sure, independent of where it was before. This is what erasure is called, okay? Yep, it's erasure because this is one bit of information, the uncertainty of having probability 1/2 here and probability 1/2 here, and this is certainty, there's no bit anymore, so you've erased your bit, okay, it's counterintuitive. So this is erasure, and Landauer was interested in how much heat and work do you need to exchange to do this process, and he showed that there's a minimum heat dissipation, which is, so, it's bigger than kBT log 2. Okay, so this is the minimum heat you have to dissipate to be able to erase one bit of information. And that is also the same as the work cost. So this is how much work you actually have to do this process. So in other words, there's a minimum, energetic minimum cost you have to pay when you manipulate information. And so in that sense, there's a link between thermodynamics and information theory. Okay. So why do I mention that? I mention that because something else came out of Landauer's argument, and that is the statement that people know, which is information is physical. Information is physical is about the fact that you can't just think about information as an abstract thing, but you have to think about it as a physical thing, so it has a thermodynamic meaning. It also, it can't travel faster than light because it has to be carried by a physical thing. And actually, out of this insight came a new field, which is called quantum information theory. So quantum information theory is about understanding that if you take quantum objects to carry your information, it will obey quantum logic, right? It will not be just like classical information, it will be different. It obeys different physical laws. And that sort of came from there. So it sort of links nicely these things together. And so that's where we are now. So our field, which is called quantum thermodynamics, and we can argue about the name, sits here. So actually the community that is doing the research comes either from quantum information theory, so such as I, so I've been a quantum information theorist, and we've been mostly looking at single particles doing quantum cryptography or computing, and now we think about more particles, so how does it then become, you know, quantum thermodynamics coming from there, basically. And then there's the statistical physics people who sort of come from that side and who are thinking about how do we make it more quantum and how do our tools become quantum. And then we actually have to agree together. That's not always easy. So this is sort of a melting pot of different ideas and things. And as you can see, there is a link between thermodynamics and information, and in particular we are interested also how does this link look like in the quantum regime. Is it still the same as what Landauer said? Are the entropies still the same, or is it actually different once you go to the quantum regime? So these are still debated questions. Okay, I think I've now, most of you are now tired and full and ready for siesta. Briefly, I think, Ronny, we have to talk about this logo. So this is the logo, right? So I made my own interpretation, not knowing what you were thinking when you made it.
They are hieroglyphs.
Hieroglyphs, yeah, sure. Of course, but what do they stand for? So as far as I can see, this is a hot bath, this is a cold bath, and these are two quantum systems that may be entangled with each other and that exchange energy with these two baths as an engine, right? So this is the engine. As I said, measurement is really important in this whole discussion. So measurement is looking. What does the system do? So this is very important. Then this knife, yeah?
This is a feather. That's a
record. Oh, it's a feather. A what?
Oh, that's a record. This is records, putting
records. Ah, okay. I was actually thinking of sort of a cutting knife. A feather. Yeah, I was thinking of a cutting knife that you know. So in thermodynamics, everything is about cutting up your system carefully, right? So there's a system, there's a bath, and you have to cut very carefully to be able to understand what you're talking about. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Yes. Yeah, that's also a very good question.
Originally, the yellow is a sun.
Yeah, that's the sign of the sun.
The sun.
But why? It's always good to have sun. Oh, maybe because it's supposed to be sunny here. Yeah.
Again, I have yet another interpretation of this. This is also the Egyptian symbol for a J, which is the symbol we use for current. And so my interpretation that this is like current of the sun or thermodynamics.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay, more questions, but not from a hard copy.
So there is a measurement process in the statistical case, right? You have to define observables.
Yes. Well, in the statistical case, actually, you may know that there's Maxwell's demon. So Maxwell's demon is a being that interrupts a thermodynamic system and actually looks inside the box and looks at each of the gas molecules. And when you do such measurements, you can extract extra work. So also in classical physics, that exists. But it's still different because you don't
actually...
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably looking at your discussion of Landauer's principle. The process of erasure, you just mean you're like reading it out or setting it to zero or something? It's obviously not the energy to destroy your qubit, because that would be like massive.
It's just resetting, yes.
The energy to reset.
Yes,
The difference between your measurement and your bath is that the bath is a classical thing that's supposed not to be changed. You don't study the bath.
Yes.
But instead, in your measurement, necessarily you have to change your microscopic object. And therefore it becomes part of your system to some extent, because you need some microscopic change.
Absolutely.
Is that the main difference in this sources of
heat? I mean, I would say so, It's quite a big difference.
Yes, it's a very big difference. Is that what you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Alexia agrees.
So I know in classical statistical mechanics, when you get to sort of small systems, smaller systems of fluctuations, you get interesting things happen, like coexistence regions. So is there something interesting, particularly quantum phenomena like that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I can't answer it yet because we are not yet there. So this is sort of the frontier for us. Yeah.